Lake Michigan, up to 25 miles per hour. But a nice day today. Right now, it is partly sunny, 30 degrees in Kenosha, 28 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're kicking off this week of morning shows in wonderful fashion with a terrific vocal jazz group that is coming to Carthage College for a concert this Thursday evening. They are called New York Voices. Before we meet one of their members, here is New York Voices in action with a recording of the song Avalon. Once again, that was the amazing quartet known as New York Voices in a performance of Avalon. And it's quite likely that that terrific song and that wonderful rendition will be part of the program that New York Voices is going to be presenting a little later this week on the campus of Carthage College. I'm very happy to have with me via the telephone one of the members of New York Voices, Darman Meter, who is going to be talking with me about the history of this group, a lot of the great things that they have done over the course of their long history. This is a group that stretches all the way back to 1986 or 1987. So they have been doing this a long, long time, and they make music at a very, very high level. Darman Meter, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. Great to be with you.
I am excited about this. I am excited that you're coming to Carthage, where I teach, and excited that we can have this conversation about your great group. Before we talk about the formation of New York Voices, tell us whatever we need to know about Darman Meter before you went off to Ithaca College and met some of these other wonderful singers with whom you make music regularly. What's the origin story of Darman Meter?
Well, yeah, I grew up in Maine, and I grew up in kind of an artistic family. My dad was actually a college professor, now retired, and he was in the arts, and my mother in the arts as well. She's a potter, makes beautiful pottery. I think my wife married me for the pottery, actually. and so I was always around the arts, and early on, I just always felt like I was going to head in a musical direction. But as a kid, I was more here listening to classical music primarily, and then of course the pop music that was on the radio back then in the 70s. But I got to college, and I was already a saxophonist as one of the instruments I was playing, and I got to college and was introduced to jazz and just kind of sort of turned my world upside down. And so I really started to focus more in that direction. And along the way, I'd always sang in choir. I loved being a choir geek as well, and when I got to Ithaca College, they had a vocal jazz ensemble, which now is more commonplace, but this is, you know, back in the early 80s, and so they were a little bit more unusual to have those at the collegiate level, and I just thought the sound was amazing. And I had also been introduced to Manhattan Transfer around those days, and which had led me to listen to other groups like Lambert Hendrickson Ross and, I don't know, the Hi-Los and Singers Unlimited and all these groups that are specialized in this group harmony sensibility with jazz, and I just kind of fell in love with that. And then New York Voices actually evolved out of Ithaca College. Three of the four of us are Ithaca grads, and we all went through this same ensemble, and it led to us eventually wanting to put a group together professionally. Kim Nazarian is the soprano, and Peter Eldridge is the bass vocalist. They're both Ithaca grads, and then Lauren Kinnon is the alto in the group, and we met her a number of years later. But Kim was actually an acting major, Peter was a classical piano major, and I was a saxophone major, but we all just shared this love of this music, and that's what sort of spurred on the development of New York Voices way back in the late 80s.
I read that the three of you from Ithaca College were on some kind of a tour, part of it, some kind of alumni group that toured Europe, and what I read kind of gives the sense that that's where, in a sense, you started to feel that special attraction to one another, musically and otherwise, in the sense that you wanted to kind of keep things going. Was that an alumni group of this jazz group you were talking about, or something else at Ithaca College?
Exactly. It was an alumni group of the vocal jazz ensemble at Ithaca College. The director, Dave Riley, had been invited to bring a group over to some of those European festivals that have these sort of collegiate outreach programs, North Sea Jazz Festival, the big festival in Montreux, and I think Nice, and some of these other things. And then we also cobbled together a few other gigs. At that moment, he didn't really feel like his college group was quite as strong as other years, and some of his, you know, to be very honest, I think some of his favorite students had just recently graduated, including Kim and Peter and I. And he said, "Hey, you guys want to do an alumni thing?" And we're like, "Sure." And that really was what spurred us on to try to do something professionally. Peter and I, we decided to write some new music for that summer project, as opposed to just doing sort of the stuff that's already out there and published. And so we were already starting to kind of create our own sound. And at that time, it was actually a six voice group at that time, and it eventually downsized to five when we first got the professional group going together. And then down to four back in 1992. But yes, that summer project was definitely the inspiration. We got such interesting and great feedback from these audiences, and it really felt like, wow, this is something that could be really interesting to do together. And I think we also were just lucky in that we all seem to have an ensemble personality, and I don't mean that just in the sense of like, well, it's fun to sing together, but also just fun to create together and having sort of the right spirit to be in a group where you have to make compromises and sort things out and you know, practice a lot to get that sound together and all those sort of things that are much more of a communal effort than maybe the more soloistic sensibility. So it just sort of serendipitous timing to all kind of line up and work together.
So tell us about the early days of New York Voices when you set out to actually do this. First of all, at the outset, was your aspiration to do this professionally? I mean, for this to be nearly your complete professional life, this group, and what was it like in the early going?
Well, you know, when you're young, you don't think that far down the road. You're just sort of naive and thinking, hey, let's try to put a band together. And you just kind of are taking it a step at a time. But I think we all had dreams and aspirations, but I don't think you ever would have been able to tell us back then that the group would go on for 35 years. But yeah, we definitely made it our focus. We were all doing other things to kind of keep a roof over our head and you know, playing in other bands and, you know, party gigs and whatever, weddings and working, and, you know, there's definitely a lot of waiting on tables by people in my group at various times in our early days. We laugh about those early days when we were out there doing gigs and trying to, you know, develop our sound, and fans would be like, wow, this is awesome. And meanwhile, then we're the next day I'm driving off somewhere to play in a wedding band, and Peter's heading off to some, you know, other gig, and Lauren's waiting on tables somewhere and whatever, you know, but that's, you know, welcome to the life of the artist trying to get a career going. You know, I can only imagine what it's like for the kids these days trying to do it. I mean, we were doing it back in the, you know, the mid-'80s, late-'80s, and God, it's I'm sure it's only more challenging. But the beauty is that we all, any of us with an artistic spirit, luckily, we sometimes are just naive enough to think we can pull it off, and so we try.
Well, and you've succeeded to an amazing extent. I wonder, you've already mentioned a couple of the other groups that you really enjoyed listening to and that your wonderful group might remind us of. I wonder, especially in the early going, as you were first trying to establish New York Voices as a distinctive part of the landscape, how much did you find yourself thinking about and comparing yourselves to groups that are already around, like, for instance, Manhattan Transfer? And to what extent was that a help, an inspiration? To what extent was that a hindrance and maybe a point of intimidation? I mean, what was it like to try to make a place for yourself in this competitive world?
Right. I think you sort of hit on all of the possibilities there, and there was a little of all of that. Manhattan Transfer was the group that I would say we were the most aware of. We were listening to them so much when we were developing our sensibility. But it's interesting, like so many categories, if you're really into something, then you might feel like, I don't know, let's just say restaurants. Like, there's these two Italian restaurants, and one person might say, they're kind of similar, and somebody else who's super tuned into Italian could kind of go, what are you talking about? You're crazy. That one's so much more northern Italy, and the other one's much more Neapolitan, and they're so different, you know. We always felt like we were so different than what they did, but to so many people, especially the critics or people writing articles or wanting to talk about this genre, they would lump us together very quickly. And so we sort of embraced that because it was like, well, they are sort of our idols, so if people want to compare us to them, that's fine with us. And we use it as a reference point to get people interested in what we're doing. But yeah, that was the one that we would always be compared to, for sure.
You, at the outset, were five voices. At some point, you ultimately shifted down to four. I think that was actually after, if I remember correctly, someone departed, they were replaced, and then someone else departed. And I think at that point, that second departure, that second departing person was not replaced, and the group was went from 5 to 4. I wonder, first of all, I hope I described that accurately. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what did that feel like to go from 5 singers to 4? Did that feel at all sort of traumatic, like an utter transformation, or did it feel like just a very subtle gradation and not all that big a deal?
Yeah, you've actually sort of nailed it again. And yes, that is the exact history. We originally were 5. The other two members were a woman named Caprice Fox, who was also another Ithaca grad, and then Sarah Krieger, who was a wonderful singer we had met in New York. It's, you know, some growing pains of the group, people deciding whether they really wanted to do it long term and this and that. And so we did have a couple of personnel changes, and that's when Lauren Kinnon joined the group after that first shift. But yeah, we kind of hit a point where I don't know, it's like, you know, are we going to continue this on? How are we going to continue this on? And as much of anything, it was more, not about the music as much as it was just financially trying to hold a band together and taking on the road. And so we had to do a little bit of a corporate downsizing maneuver. And when Caprice decided to leave, we had the option of going out and trying to find the new fifth voice for the group. And we had felt like we'd gotten so lucky meeting Lauren and going through this audition process where we had, like, listened to, I don't know, 70 different people to figure out the person that would fit. And as you know, being around music so much, the music part is only half of it. The other half is, can you be a family? You know, can you go on the road together? Can you enjoy that life and figure out how to coexist in a musical group? We had gotten so lucky with making that transition with Lauren. We were like, I don't know if I want to even trust that we could do that again. So we thought about it, and, you know, it's funny, we were talking about Manhattan Transfer. One of the things we always would say, you know, is like, yeah, but there are 4 voices. We're 5. That makes us so different. And but to the average person, they don't care. So we're like, oh, heck with it. Let's just be a quartet, and it'll be easier to coexist. It'll be easier to, you know, pay for flights to get to wherever, you know, whatever, split the pie 4 ways. And musically, at first, it felt weird, for sure. Yeah, it was kind of like having, you know, losing a limb or something. I don't know, that's a weird comparison, but it really did feel very strange, those first number of gigs, as we tried to reconfigure the music. But ultimately, we actually felt like our sound got stronger, and we were, because we felt like the individual voices were sort of more defined, and now we look back and it feels like a lifetime ago that we were a quintet. It feels very natural to be a quartet.
We're speaking with Darman Meter, one of the founding members of New York Voices, and this jazz quartet is going to be performing at Carthage College this Thursday evening, the 23rd of February, 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel. So your group has been around since 1986, 87, something like that. So more than 35 years you have been at it and sounding as wonderful as ever. I wonder if you can just say a word about the way voices age and change over the course of that length of time. As a singer myself, I'm very aware of that reality, and voices change sometimes for the better. And sometimes in other ways that represent, you know, more of a loss of range or flexibility or whatever. And I think it's one thing when you are just a person and sort of riding that wave of however your voice is changing. It's something else when you have 4 people and each of you have a voice that has changed and evolved and grown and whatever over that long period of time. Has it been a relatively smooth transition for all of you over the course of this long period of time, just in terms of the 4 voices and how they work together?
Yeah, we are holding together pretty well. It's so funny. Right? You're asking very pertinent questions. Because, yeah, we're all, I mean, you know, do the math. We're all, you know, many of us have already seen the number 60 pass by. And as vocalists get older, things do change. And if you're a solo vocalist, you can adapt in certain ways that might be easier than when you're in an ensemble. I mean, the only thing we can do in an ensemble is decide to, you know, if we're feeling like we don't have the spry vocal cords that we had when we were younger, you can decide to I don't know, change the key of the song and drop it a step or something. And, you know, you can play those kind of games. But the truth of the matter is what we create, you know, there's parts that have to be sung. And if you can't do it anymore, then, you know, time's up. But we have not, you know, we have not gotten there. We do find there's certain tunes that feel a lot different singing them now, and maybe a little harder to sing now than they did when we were younger. And so there's certain songs that maybe we don't even do anymore for whatever reason, and some of it might be range or comfort zone, but sometimes it's just because musically it feels like, oh God, that so feels like something I would have sung in 1992. I don't want to do that anymore. Hmm. And also stylistically, we've shifted over time. You know, I mean, you mentioned the 1980s. We all remember what the music sounded like back then, and we were kids of, you know, the pop music from the 70s and those influences as well. And so we had sort of that fusion side to our personality when we were younger. Some of that has been set aside, and I feel like we lean much more towards an acoustic jazz sensibility. So that's another reason why certain tunes have sort of been shelved at times. But yeah, we all try to stay in good shape vocally. We figure out ways to maybe do some things slightly differently than we might have when we were just young and could just, you know, just wail away on things. But and we write repertoire for ourselves slightly differently now when we're adding new repertoire, in terms of just finding the key that feels right or the approach that feels right for our more, we'll say, mature voices.
Right. And I might add that wonderful recording of Avalon, which we heard at the outset, that's very recent. I think that might be 2021.
Well, that specific one, it was fun that you grabbed that, because that's not her. You might be the first person to actually play that on the radio, because our album version is, which is from our album called Reminiscing in Tempo, which is an album that came out in 2019. Our album version of Avalon is with full big band. But during the pandemic, we were all trying to figure out ways to still be creative. And the name New York Voices is a little deceptive in that back in the day, we all lived in New York. But at this point, we're very spread out. We have one member in Ohio, one in New Hampshire, one on Long Island. I'm upstate New York. And so we just didn't see each other for, you know, a year and a half, maybe, before we actually fully got together as a quartet.
Wow.
So we all learned to do the long-distance virtual recording thing. And so that was a fun one that we decided to put together, where we downsized it to a much smaller group with a couple other friends, our friend Reggie Bowens singing the bass line, so it became more of an a cappella group, and a friend of ours from Japan doing vocal percussion, and a guitar player, Jesse Lewis, joining us to kind of give us that Freddie Green guitar thing. And so that's what you grabbed, and you found that on YouTube, which there's a fun, you know, one of those little multi-box videos of us doing that. And so we did a number of things like that during the pandemic to kind of keep things rolling. Hmm. And yeah, if anybody does a quick search for us, you might see a few of those.
Absolutely. And I only mention it because I think you all sound fresh as a daisy. I mean, I would listen to that, and I would not necessarily think, yeah, this sounds like a group that's been singing for almost 40 years together. I mean, you might as well be fresh out of college in terms of just the freshness and buoyancy with which you sing, and the wonderful balance, the incredible blend. I mean, that is first-rate singing.
Well, thank you. And we, you know, we do try to take it very seriously in terms of the upkeep of our voices and, you know, doing all the right stuff staying fit vocally, and all the warm-ups and the kind of things you need to do. You know, sometimes there's a misnomer that, like, you know, the classical singers do all the technique stuff, and the jazz and pop singers, they just sing. And it's like, that is so wrong. You know, we just sing with a different approach, but we still need to do it right. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to be doing it for over 30 years.
Absolutely. I wonder if you can talk about the sort of the artistic sensibility that each of you bring to the task of putting this group together and your repertoire and so on. I mean, do you kind of come to the table all, in a sense, loving the same things, loving the same kind of music and being drawn to the same things? Or are there any ways in which you come from slightly different places in terms of what interests you, what you find most stimulating, and then do we end up with kind of a interesting mix of the contributions that you make in that respect.
Yeah, I think, you really hit on an important part of what makes our group who we are. We are not all the same. We don't have all exactly the same tastes in music or approaches to singing. But I'd make the analogy, I don't know what you call those drawings where you might have four different circles that represent different ideas, but they all share some commonality, and so you see that area where the four circles overlap. There's got to be some name for that drawing. I don't know what it is, but that's kind of the way we are. There's clearly some areas that we are so in agreement about how we want to approach certain styles of music, and some of that, actually, to be honest, has evolved collectively. We've been students of the music through all these years. I mean, having chances to go on the road with, I don't know, groups like the Count Basie Orchestra, for example, where we're just schooled in like hardcore swing style, or working with Paquito de Rivera or Ivan Lins, and really living in Brazilian music and things like that. So a lot of it we've learned as we've evolved. But we all brought a lot of different things to the table. I'm a saxophonist, as I mentioned early on, and I still play saxophone in the group. So I really come at the music with a very instrumental sensibility, both the way I play and sing and also the way I write for New York Voices. Peter Eldridge was some of his favorite music growing up was people like Joni Mitchell and, Steely Dan, Stevie Wonder, things like that. And so there's a lot of elements of those sensibilities that come in. And then Lauren and Kim also, Kim is a huge advocate of Brazilian music, and so she loves to bring some of those ideas and concepts to the table. Lauren is a wonderful songwriter. Both Lauren and Peter have a lot of solo projects that they've done where they've written their own music, which bridges that sort of jazz and singer-songwriter world, and so you can hear a lot of those elements where they really explore that even further in their own music, but then, of course, they bring that into New York Voices as well.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about what people can expect from the concert that you're going to be presenting at Carthage this Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. First of all, will this be a completely a cappella performance?
It will not. We rarely do a full a cappella concert. That's not really where our roots were. We have a cappella music in the set, and there will be, I'm sure, a few of those on the concert. But our typical setup is to perform with rhythm section of piano, bass, and drums. Oh. And we have some favorite guys and the people that we've used over the years, and we've got some of our favorites coming out with us on this trip. A wonderful pianist named Sean Fitzpatrick, Paul Nowinski on bass, and Marcello Pelletieri, a drummer that's worked with us for many, many years. So they will be joining us, and so it'll be that full rhythm section sound supporting our four-part harmony. I oftentimes will make the comparison for people that are new to what we do. The way that we write for New York Voices is almost like four horns, or maybe like the saxophone section in a big band. So, and when you hear those kind of instrumental orchestrations, you usually have the rhythm section supporting underneath. So that's kind of the way it works for us. And we'll be doing repertoire ranging from very traditional jazz-based things like Avalon, as you played, or we have a Dave Brubeck tune called Blue Rondo a la Turk, or a wonderful old Duke Ellington ballad called Reminiscing in Tempo. We'll do a couple of Ivan Lins tunes. We'll do, who knows, we might do a Joni Mitchell tune or a Stevie Wonder tune. We do take some classic pop tunes and kind of restructure them for the way we approach music, and so we like to take the audience on a nice ride so that they get to experience a lot of different styles, but the connecting thread is this four-part harmony that we love to create.
Wonderful. You are the tenor of the group, and I wonder what kind of special challenges and pleasures does that present?
Well, I better warm up properly. Yeah, the tenor, we all know it's like tenors. I mean, especially in classical music, of course, what's the long career for the tenor? And then and all of a sudden, you kind of go, "Oh, my favorite tenor is now singing baritone roles," or lead trumpet players, right? They drop down to third trumpet eventually. So I definitely try to stay in good shape to keep that role going. And likewise, Kim is the lead soprano most of the time. Although Kim and Lauren switch from song to song a bit, but Kim is the one. If you hear some crazy high notes, that's probably Kim. And she actually is quite remarkable in that she still has pretty much, God, I think almost exactly the range that she had when we started recording our first album back in 1988. So she's remarkable at keeping that going. There's definitely a certain athleticism in what we do at times, but we try not to just hit the audience with just, the wow factor all the time. We also try to bring, one of the things we love to try to do is really stay connected to what the meaning of these songs are. What are the lyrics? Sometimes this genre can get to be too much about the harmony and the feel and not about the substance, the emotion behind the song. So we're trying to hold on to that as well.
Mm, very good. Well, that room in which you're going to be performing Thursday night has seen the likes of Chanticleer and the King Singers and Anonymous Four and Voces Eight and New York Voices is the next in a long line of superlative vocal groups that have graced that space. And I know a lot of people are excited that you are coming to share your very special artistry with us here in southeastern Wisconsin. New York Voices, again, will be performing Thursday evening in Siebert Chapel, a concert at 7:30 p.m. Four wonderful voices, including my morning show guest today, Darman Meter. And Darman, as we finish out, we're going to be listening to something called Blue Rondo a la Turk. Tell our listeners just a little bit about this.
Yeah, it's a classic Dave Brubeck tune that I'd always loved. And then also, there's those of a certain age, myself included, might remember a wonderful version by Al Jarreau back in the 80s. Or maybe late 70s, and Al wrote this wonderful lyric to this instrumental tune, and we decided to run with that and create a version of our own. And it's a pretty big tune and one that we love to do. So we'll definitely be doing that on the gig. But yeah, enjoy listening to it right now.
We'll give it a little sneak preview for our listeners. And in the meantime, Darman Meter, thank you for making time in your schedule to join me today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you. Best wishes to you and your colleagues in New York Voices.
Thank you so much, Greg.
We could be laughing, crying. Next thing, our bellies are dancing around the floor. Never thought that the feeling, unfamiliar, strange at first,
the same as your so-called blues.
A thread over the thread,
round and round the melody goes,
and now it's gone straight to my head,
straight
my
to
head.
Who knows?
Put one foot here and one foot there. I can't believe I'm moving to this.
Run, run, run the melody, run, run, run the harmony.
Blue melody round the world, you know what I mean.
From their album Reminiscing in Tempo, that was New York Voices with Blue Rondo a la Turk. This is one of the pieces they plan to perform for their Thursday evening concert, 7:30 p.m. at Carthage College's Siebert Chapel. To purchase tickets, you can call the Carthage box office at 262-551-6661. They are open weekdays from 12 until 5. Or you can go online to carthage.edu/tickets. My thanks to Darman Meter once again for being my guest in this portion of the Monday Morning Show here on WGTD. And here's part two. And I am very excited to be reconnecting in this portion of the morning show with an incredibly talented and successful young writer named Mackenzie Lee. And we spoke a few months ago, or I guess it's maybe been over a year actually, about a wonderful novel for young adult readers that she wrote for Marvel. And she has another one which completes a very intriguing trilogy called, it's called Winter Soldier. And we'll get to the specifics of this wonderful, exciting, and fascinating book in just a moment. But first of all, Mackenzie Lee, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Time flies.
It really does. I wanted to ask you first, before we get into the book, I read that you earned your master's degree from Simmons University in writing for children and young adults. And I have to confess, it never occurred to me that that might be a specific academic discipline, that is, writing for children and young adults.
It didn't occur to me either until I was Googling it one day and said, hey, this would be funny if I got this degree.
Wow. So it from the sounds of it, you had this interest and this intention from from fairly early on to focus your creative energies in this way. For any particular reason, what draws you to want to write for this particular audience?
Well, when I was a kid, I was a big reader. And then when I sort of aged out of children's books and had all these sort of classic novels foisted upon me as like, this is the thing you read next, I kind of lost interest in books and reading. And then as an adult, when I revisited a lot of the books I read as a kid, that was the thing that got me back into reading. And I just think it's such an exciting age to be writing for. When you're young, you're so open and so ready to accept what you're given and what you're told, and to be impacted by the books you read. And I think about the books that I read as a kid, they still stay with me. And I think about them all the time. And in so many ways, like, I am the person I am today because of what I read. And that's such a powerful age to be writing for. And it's the time of life that excites me. Those are the readers I want.
Hmm. I think one thing that also sets you apart is your earnest interest in history. And I know at some point you were a history major in your studies, and history is a very powerful element even in your fiction. And of course, you've written some nonfiction as well. Can you talk for a moment about having, you know, one foot planted in fiction and in nonfiction, and with kind of history living in both of those arenas? Or does it all, in a sense, kind of blend together and not feel like separate compartments at all?
I mean, I always think of the Sherlock Holmes line, the real life is infinitely stranger than the mind of man can invent. And there's so much in history that if you put it in a novel as fiction, people would say, well, this is too absurd, this is too on the nose, this is too strange to be real, or for people to believe this would ever happen. But it is. It's history. It's things that happen. And I think that's so interesting and hilarious and exciting and fun to study. I also am someone who got interested in history initially because of historical fiction. And I really like historical fiction's ability to remind us that history is not something that happened to groups of people all the same way. It's not something that happened on a mass scale. We often, when we study history, we talk about these big events happening to a lot of people, when really history and life is something that happens on an individual level. And there's so much individuality that gets lost when you study history, and historical fiction is a great way to bring that back and remind you that the people in the past were indeed that. They were people that were experiencing cataclysmic events and big changes and big shifts in history on an individual human level.
Well put. We're talking with best-selling author Mackenzie Lee, And we're about to begin talking specifically about her most recent book, which is called Winter Soldier. It completes a trilogy of novels for young adult readers that she was asked to write by the folks at Marvel. I'm really curious to know, and we may have talked about this when we talked in our previous interview about the second in the trilogy, Gamora and Nebula, Sisters in Arms. But even if we did talk about it, remind me and our listeners, what exactly was the invitation that came to you from the folks at Marvel? What did they want from you? And then within that, what was left up to you in terms of specific choices about where to take the project?
I mean, it was kind of a dream scenario. I think people often hear that I write for Marvel and they think, oh, they told you, they gave you the plot, they told you what to write. They assume they gave me an outline and I just had to connect the dots. When really what happened is they came to me with this proposal that they wanted to release three novels about anti-heroes in the Marvel Universe. They're sort of morally gray characters, showing them earlier in their timelines than we'd seen them before, so showing them as teenagers. And they wanted all three of them to have sort of a strong historical component to them, which is why they specifically thought of me for this project, is because the editor was a fan of my historical work. And then from there, it was almost all left up to me. I had to go through approval processes, right? They're very closely monitoring everything that's going on with all the different characters at any given moment in their Marvel universe to make sure people aren't writing wildly contradicting stories or characterizations or what have you. They want to make sure there's some continuity in this enormous multiverse of madness, to borrow a phrase. So I did a lot of outlining, a lot of brainstorming with the team at Marvel. But in the end, they left so much of it up to me and let me bring a lot of things I was specifically interested in and passionate about. Like with Gamora and Nebula, I told them that they said we want to do this a little more sci-fi because they're alien characters. None of their stories take place on Earth. And I said, great, I'd love to do a space Western and really base it on sort of the Western diaspora of the United States and talk about manifest destiny and strip mining and fanatical religion and all of these things that come up in the West. And they were immediately supportive of that and sort of provided me with existing comic book lore that could support this plot and my ideas for it. And it was really a great collaborative process. I feel really, really lucky.
Hmm. Just to clarify, so that was your previous book, and the trilogy started with a wonderful novel about Loki, who of course is in the storyline of Thor, the Thunder God. Did they choose the, in a sense, subject matter of each of these three novels, that is, who they would focus on, or was that choice also left up to you? I mean, for you to sift through all of the many potential characters in the Marvel Universe and then select these to focus on?
They came with kind of a short list. So the only one that was decided for sure was they started with Loki and they said, we want to start here and then we'll sort of reevaluate after every book and sort of see who's popping off in the Marvel Universe. And so we talked about Gamora and Nebula because they had, I think Infinity War, Endgame, one of the big movies had just come out, and both of them were sort of their breakout. I mean, they were in the previous movies, but they had been getting a lot of fan attention because of their roles in Endgame and Infinity War. And so we did them sort of as a result of that. And then for the third one, they brought me a short list and said, here's like five or so characters we'd be interested in. And I came back and I said, these are all great, but my absolute favorite character in Marvel is Bucky Barnes, and I'd really love to do a Bucky Barnes Winter Soldier book. And they said, sure.
Hmm.
So it was again, a great collaborative process.
So that is a name that is not going to be particularly familiar to a lot of our listeners. Those of us who know the comic book world of Marvel know who Bucky Barnes is. Explain for a beginner or a newcomer to this who he is and what so much intrigued you about his story.
So Bucky is Captain America's sidekick, to put it in sort of most basic terms. He was the guy sort of standing at Captain America's right hand for all of World War II, and then Captain America's sort of black and white benevolent actions often left the need for a cleanup crew or maybe somebody to come in and take care of things that so that Steve Rogers didn't have to get his hands dirty. And Bucky was that guy for him. And then later in life, he's captured by the Soviet Union and brainwashed and becomes this Soviet agent with no memory of who he was before or what his previous involvement with Captain America was. And so you get these sort of two intersecting characterizations and characters for these two different stories for the same character as well. And I was very interested in the way these two things interact and how what about us is essential and what pieces of our identity can't be taken away from us even when you sort of wipe a person clean and take away everything that you think they were.
You've made the choice to, in effect, toggle back and forth. And I think it's done really effectively. But I think it's the kind of thing that is exceedingly difficult to pull off. That is to, in a sense, toggle between two different time frames and to kind of blend disparate story elements together into one cohesive whole. I'm very impressed with how well you pulled that off, but I wonder, were you at all intimidated by the prospect of doing it, or is your background in history the kind of thing that maybe especially equipped you to do that as well as you do?
Oh, no, I was tremendously intimidated. I'm still terrified that I that I did it wrong or didn't do it as well as I could, but part of the opportunity with the Marvel books is that there's so much of the world building is already done for you, right? Like, people already know these characters. I don't have to bring a ton of unique characterization or unique world building. So I really wanted to make sure that I was challenging myself creatively in other ways, and so I wanted to structurally do things I hadn't done before. So in this case, it was the toggling between the two timelines in Gamora and Nebula. I'd never written a book from two points of view, which ended up being tricky because you have to sort of keep track of who knows what at what moment in the story. And so I wanted to make sure I was still creatively challenging myself, even if I wasn't doing all the heavy lifting in terms of the world building.
I really appreciated what you said earlier about how the folks at Marvel understandably feel the need to exert at least a little bit of control over what is done in terms of developing all of their various characters. And you end up with a certain kind of chaos that's probably counterproductive if everybody is given completely free rein artistically. That might feel good in the moment for a given writer, but for those who you want to explore this universe and make sense of it, it really causes all kinds of problems. Can you just kind of take us inside the process by which you constructed this sort of as yet untold backstory of Bucky Barnes and the way in which you collaborated with Marvel in shaping this story into something that would work well within the universe, being cohesive and true to the tradition and yet saying something new?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of back and forth. It's about, I came to the table sort of knowing what I wanted to do and having this sort of, I had references, right? Like I talked about, I really love John le Carré, and I was really inspired by him and his sort of Cold War spy novels. I also brought to the table, I just watched The Queen's Gambit was something that I was bringing to the table. My favorite book is this World War II spy novel called Codename Verity. So I brought sort of my references and I said, these are the things I would like to channel in terms of plot, in terms of genre, in terms of a vibe. And also I had done a lot of reading of the Winter Soldier comics. I sort of figured out what canon exists, what holes I would like to fill in, et cetera. And I did my little presentation of here's what I'm doing. And then Marvel came back and they said, great, we love all this. You might want to look at this existing plot line. You might want to look at here's what so-and-so did with this storyline that might be similar. Here's some existing comic lore that maybe you could bring in to tie it all together, because we know people really love that, like the connections and the multiverse element of it. And it ends up being a ton of back and forth with a lot of different people who all have their different expertise. I'm not just working with editors who are helping me creatively with the book and doing things like talking about story structure and character arcs, but you're also talking to people whose job seems to be professionally reading and remembering comics, who can then refer me to, well, in this issue of this run by so-and-so about Captain America, we see this story for Bucky, and that might be something to look into that you're going to want to reference later. And it was an incredibly collaborative process. It was sort of a dream, like the best case scenario for what you can hope for when you work on projects like this.
Fantastic. Very quickly, are you sorry to see this trilogy end, and what is next for you?